It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Mike Arnold. Coming up, we are finishing our month-long Out in Wisconsin series featuring stories from Wisconsin's LGBT community. Today, we talk about the special role gays and transgender people play in some Native American communities.
First, the weather's heating up, and with July 4th around the corner, lots of us maybe have plans to hit the lakes. If you're staying in Wisconsin, the National Resources Defense Council has some news that is not particularly good.
Yes, according to the NRDC, the water quality at Wisconsin's beaches ranks 8th worst in the country, or 23rd out of 30 states that have shorelines on lakes and oceans. The number is based on the percentage of water samples taken from Wisconsin beaches that had bacterial counts that exceeded standards from the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency in 2013.
As a whole, the Great Lakes region performed the worst in the country in the report. Here to tell us why and what we can do is Josh Mogerman, Deputy Director of National Media at the National Resources Defense Council's Midwest office. Josh, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
So, you know, it's summer. We've been waiting all winter to get in the water, hit the beaches in Wisconsin. Is this news troublesome enough that maybe we should stay away from the lakes?
Well, I think it's important to know before you go. You don't want to head out on days where you're potentially putting your family in danger of having a really uncomfortable result of that fun day at the beach. Nobody wants to be dealing with kids with stomach aches or adults with worse intestinal problems that result from swimming in water that may have been contaminated. You know, we have a problem in the Great Lakes that is a bit more acute than what we see on both of our coasts, and that has a lot to do with the nature of the lakes, the lack of movement of water within them that makes it difficult to move pollution and contamination sometimes. And it's something that we have to be aware of and that we have to think about when we're planning our beach trips.
And when we're talking about pollution and contamination in the lakes, what kinds of things are we talking about or in the water that could make us sick?
Well, you know, most of the time we're talking about issues of runoff. We're talking about stormwater that has brought an array of other stuff into the water, or we're talking about industrial pollution that's made its way in. But ultimately, we're talking about the little bugs that that are in the water that cause us digestive distress, and you know, no need to go into the uncomfortable nature of what happens. But oftentimes, when we go into water that has contamination, that has a lot of E. coli and other bacteria from human and animal waste, that can result in really significant discomfort. And you know, on its surface, this seems like it's a really sort of trivial problem. People get a tummy ache after going into the water, but at the beach, this is one of the places where we deal with a very big issue of water pollution head on. For a lot of people, this very huge issue is something that is far off. It doesn't affect their lives on a day-to-day basis. But yet at the beach, you are directly confronted and at times feeling the results of the way we're managing our water infrastructure and the impact of the way we treat our water resources, they can have a real effect on your day-to-day life.
Okay, so let's say we want to hit one of the beaches, say, in Milwaukee. Is the water quality any better if you get farther away from the shore? Is there an area where the concentration of pollutants is denser, or is it pretty much a uniform thing?
No, you know, each beach is very, very different. The physical aspects of the beach, the way the water moves around it, in some cases the proximity to infrastructure, those can make things very, very different from beach to beach and from day to day. Certainly in Milwaukee, we have a couple, or in Milwaukee County anyway, a couple of beaches that have a history of being problematic. You know, South Shore Beach is a beach that 42% of the water samples that came from there exceeded the beach action value, a health a margin by which the EPA says there's too much bacteria in the water, it's dangerous for or problematic for human health. So there are a few beaches in Milwaukee County that are problematic. So you have South Shore Beach, you have Grant Park Beach, which was exceeding things 31% of the time, Bradford Beach 22% of the time, and Bender Beach 16% of the time. All those are Milwaukee County beaches.
What about beaches on Lake Superior? We think of that being cold and maybe a little bit cleaner. What do those beaches look like?
You know, across the board in Wisconsin, we're looking at slightly higher than average contamination rates across the board for the state of Wisconsin. We're looking at 14% of the samples exceeding the federal standard, and there is a lot of difference in that. There are fewer monitored beaches along the Lake Superior shoreline. There certainly are a number of beaches that also have high exceedance rates up there, and again, that oftentimes is related to potential proximity to infrastructure. When it rains, water makes its way into our combined sewer systems. They get overloaded, and that storm water mixes with wastewater, and it ends up getting whooshed out into the lakes or into our waterways that eventually drain into our lakes. And that's one of the reasons why it's very important for people to be cognizant of how recently it's rained. You definitely don't want to go to the beach the day after it rains, and that's been problematic given the early summer that we've had with a lot of rain. And if there's been a heavy rain, you probably want to wait about 3 days before you go to the beach.
3 days. Well, you said the Great Lakes region in general has particular problems that have to do with the way, I guess, the water circulates or doesn't circulate. Why are the Great Lakes so problematic?
Well, you know, you think about the difference. We think about the Great Lakes as these wonderfully huge seas of fresh water. But when you compare them to the marine ecosystem along the coast, where you have salt water and you have a lot of wave action and you have much, much bigger bodies of water to dilute the pollution, the issues are dealt with a little more quickly along the coast than they are here in the Great Lakes. It's just a function of the volume of water. But we do have plenty of legacy of industrial pollution that remains to be a problem. The other thing is we are feeling the impacts of climate change already doing things that are impacting our beach water quality. We are having more and more of these storms that are hugely intense, dumping large volumes of rainwater on us at a given time and overwhelming our storm infrastructure and setting up those long periods of potential contamination. Those are issues that are hugely important. You have in some of the shallower portions of the lakes, like the western portion of Lake Erie and in Green Bay, areas where we're seeing increased amounts of big algae blooms that have to do with a warming of the water and an increased amount of nutrient pollution, fertilizer, that's making its way in and helping these algae blooms grow. These are things that are problematic for our enjoyment, but also point to bigger problems that we really need to address.
So Wisconsin beaches ranking the eighth worst in the country. What does Wisconsin need to do to start cleaning up the beaches and making these waterways safe for people who want to swim and recreate in them?
Sure. You know, there are a lot of simple solutions that can be addressed. It's an embrace of things like green infrastructure, something that Milwaukee County is doing a lot with, using natural surfaces to collect, hold, and filter rainwater where it falls. We're seeing plenty of places where that's being deployed to help be a buffer for beaches so that when we do have these big rain days, less of that contaminated runoff makes its way to the beach and into the lakes. But mostly this is very much about making sure that we know what's going on in our beaches, that we identify the sources of contamination. One of the problems that we have throughout the Great Lakes is we know that the contamination rates are high. We don't necessarily know exactly where it's coming from. It's non-point specific runoff. It could be coming from a lot of places. And there's work to be done from at the state level and nationally to shore up infrastructure and to get a better handle on where those points of contamination are coming from. And for you and I, the biggest thing is to know before we go. We need to check those check in with the information on the specific beaches we're going to and make sure that today is a good beach day and we're not going in on days when we're putting ourselves in harm's way because of high levels of contamination.
Okay, Josh, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks very much for having me. Have a good weekend.
You too. We've been speaking with Josh Mogerman of the National Resources Defense Council in Chicago. The NRDC recently released a report ranking Wisconsin's beaches as the 8th worst in the country for water quality. We're wrapping up our month-long Out in Wisconsin series. Each Friday in June, we featured a story from Wisconsin's LGBT community. Last week, we talked with the organizer of Wausau's first ever LGBT Pride event.
Today, we're speaking with a member of the Rosebud Sioux Tribe about his experience as a Winkte. That's W-I-N-K-T-E. In Lakota culture, a Winkte is a gay or transgender member of the community who often takes on a special spiritual or leadership role.
Each tribe has its own way of describing the members of the community, but in English, they're often referred to as two-spirit people embodying both aspects of male and female realms.
Two-spirit people have been acknowledged in over 130 different North American tribes across every region of the continent.
Here in the studio with us to talk about his experience as a Winkte is Isaiah Brokenleg. He's a member of the Rosebud Sioux Tribe and program director at the Great Lakes Intertribal Epidemiology Center. Isaiah, welcome to Central Time.
It's great to be here.
So let's start with the term Winkte itself. How would you describe what that means?
Well, it's actually pronounced Winkte, and it's actually short for a longer word, Wi'inkte. And in Lakota language, the kte and we means girl, kte means to kill, so that's not actually what it means. it's sort of means to like, or we ink day is the longer version, and it means to talk like a woman, maybe is a better way to sort of explain it. So in Lakota language, rather than an object or a thing being a male or female, like in Spanish, it's the person who's talking that changes the endings of words and sentences to make them the speaker either being male or female. So in other words, it's a male-bodied person who speaks like a woman.
A common English term, I gather, from anthropologists to describe Winkte across different tribes is a two-spirit person. Can you tell us a little bit about that term and whether you think it fits? Does it embody the term that you just told me about?
Well, I think that the term two-spirit came about a long time ago. Well, maybe not that long ago, but like the 60s, 70s, during that time when this kind of like a pan-Indian movement where lots of different tribes were getting together in urban areas and talking about their shared experiences and shared struggles. And most tribes all had this idea of a concept of this other gendered or other sexual orientation role that they had in their community. But in each language, you know, you have over 560 tribes. So each language has a different word for that thing. And they really wanted a word that they could use that could describe this idea or this thing. And anthropologists used the word burdash a long time ago. And that sort of referred to folks outside of the United States, I think in like the Middle East. And it was more of a it was a completely different role, and we didn't like the connotations that it had. And so two-spirit was sort of the one that they came up with. And so it's a created word that a lot of American Indians use to identify themselves. Two-spirit meaning having the spirits of masculine and feminine, but also in many cases walking between the worlds of the natural and the supernatural.
And so is Winkte just the Sioux word, but there are corollaries in different tribal languages?
Right. Winkte is a Lakota word, and I'm sure the word translates into Dakota and Nakota as well. But in each language or tribe, they'll have their own word for this thing, and it is different everywhere. So I'm not actually familiar with what the Ojibwe word is, but that's the majority American Indian population here.
And what role have the Winkte traditionally played in the community?
Well, I think that they are... Well, let me explain. I was raised by my grandparents, and they told me stories, and that's sort of the medium of education in Indian country, or at least a traditional medium of education. And they told me stories about how Winkte were to behave and act. And I thought they told all my cousins these stories, but they only told them like one or two stories, and I got told many stories. So I think that's kind of what ended up helping me in my process. But I think that with most leadership roles, it's really more of a servant leadership. So you're sort of a servant to the community, and your responsibility sometimes is taking care of children. Sometimes it's very spiritual roles. You have unique spiritual and social roles that you fulfill. And the way I was told was, you know, if somebody asks you to do something, your job is to do it or try and help make that happen. So if somebody asks you to pray for them, you pray for them. If they ask you to come be an MC at an event, that's your responsibility to come and do that. Like most leadership, it's leadership by example, as opposed to sort of this idea of Western leadership, where you're kind of there to reign over people. That's it's not like that.
So it's service hand in hand with leadership. Can you remember a particular time where your role as a Wingday was particularly relevant or encapsulates what we're talking about here?
I think in the community, I have a few friends, and recently one of them lost her brother, and she had asked me to help, you know, as he was in the process of passing away, and help with his transition into the spirit world and help the family with those processes. And so there were things that I did, sometimes singing, sometimes praying, being there at the funeral, supporting the family, those kind of roles. Other times people asked me to do different things in the community, and you just do them.
And as a Wingday, how do you relate to the broader LGBT community? You're Lakota, you live in the United States, there's a lot happening on the LGBT front right now in this country. How do you see yourself in that context?
Well, I think it's a struggle. And for me, I might make some people angry. I think that what I found, at least in the LGBT community, is often, you know, with it, is a microcosm of the larger community. So there's racism and sexism and all of those things in the LGBT community, transphobia, all of those things. And so in the gay community, I feel like I can only be gay. I can't be gay and Indian. So I can only have the one hat on. And I really like working with the American Indian community, because there I can be gay or Wingday, and I can be Indian also. I don't have to leave one of my hats at the door. And I think that's kind of been a struggle for me sometimes. And I think as the LGBT community sort of changes and transforms its understanding of social justice, I think you'll see changes too that are coming on. And for many people, I think the LGBT community is really like the white male LGBT community, not really, doesn't always allow in other folks into it in a good way or in a healthy way.
So narrow definitions, is that why you think it is that you are only allowed to, you have to pick one box and check it and that's it for right now?
I guess I'm not sure where it comes from. I think people, when they come into different communities, they'll bring their privileges with them. And so, you know, if you have a male-dominated society or a white-dominated society, they're going to bring those privileges into the community that they have, even if it is a microcosm of the larger one.
Is there a strong sense of cohesion and community among Wingday?
Well, I think among the Two-Spirit community, there's a very a broader sense of cohesion. And I don't think there used to be. That was often something that was suppressed back, let's say, in the 50s and 60s and so forth. And so I think there's really been this blossoming of Two-Spirit identified folks coming forward. And they actually have many different Two-Spirit societies throughout the country. There's one in Minneapolis and Denver. There's one in the Northeast, sort of New York-ish area. And they are doing some amazing things.
I was reading earlier a paper written by Wingday, and she said that, this is a quote, when nature puts a burden on someone, it also gives them power. It kind of makes you sound like Superman. But do you feel like that? Do you feel like you have a burden and power at the same time?
I think that the idea, you know, what doesn't kill you make you stronger is true. I think that in the Lakota culture, though, being a Wingday is viewed as a blessing. So it's a kind of like your blessing on your family, as opposed to, I think, in many families, kind of viewed as the black sheep. And I think the experience I've had throughout my life, or struggles that I've had, have given me power, helped me be stronger and helped me be more understanding. And I think the idea of Wingday, or person walking between the two worlds, masculine, feminine, natural and supernatural, that I think gives you a much broader understanding. And I think that's why a lot of times they were the healers and the counselors of the community, because they could understand these different perspectives. And often they were used as the translators or people who help to build conciliation when there's conflict, especially between non-Indians and Indian communities.
Now, you said that your grandparents raised you and they told you the stories that they thought you needed to hear. They prepared you. Has that been true in with the rest of your family and your experience within the community?
Yeah, I think for the most part, at least among the Indians, I've heard lots of different stories. When I left my grandparents and I moved to Seattle, and I got kicked out of the house when I came out or was found out, or however you want to say that. And that was a really powerful experience for me. And definitely, I think that made me a stronger person. And I think that there were American Indian men and women who sort of took me under their wing and kind of said, hey, there's this role and you need to live into it. And that's, rather than coming out, that's more of a coming in, I guess, or a coming in experience. And I think they really helped and build who I am. And
we're speaking right now with Isaiah Brokenleg as part of our Out in Wisconsin series featuring stories from Wisconsin's LGBT community. He's talking about his experience as a Winkti, people who are commonly referred to as Two-Spirit people of the Native American community.
I'm Mike Arnold.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Central Time. I'm Mike Arnold.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're back now with Isaiah Brokenleg in studio as part of our Out in Wisconsin series featuring stories from Wisconsin's LGBT community. He's talking about his experience as a Winkti in his Native American community. Winkti are also known as Two-Spirit people and are gay or transgender people who have a special spiritual or leadership role to play in their community.
And we'd like to hear from you. Do you have questions about the Winkti community, about Two-Spirit people? We'd like to hear from you about that. Also, how does your community respond to LGBT people? Call 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're going to go right to our callers. Now we have Deborah with us from Evansville. Hi, Deborah.
Hello. I'm so excited to hear this idea resurrected about the go-betweens. When I was in college in the 70s, I remember being excited about the two-spirited people being called go-betweens. And I wonder if Isaiah recalls that sort of being another part of the language of especially bisexual and gay community during what we would call gay back then.
All right. Thanks, Deborah. Go-betweens, is that something that you remember?
I've heard, well, I was born in the late 70s, so I don't remember the 70s, but I do remember hearing people refer to it that way before. In fact, one of the women that I taught me a lot, she referred to it as a go-between.
Now, before we went to the news, you were talking about what you called your coming in. You thought that's a better term, more fitting for what happened to you. I wonder if you could describe that a little bit for you, what that process of coming in was like.
Well, I think for a lot of American Indian folks who are LGBT, coming out, for mainstream folks, coming out is this thing, you know, like you're going to have to tell people who you are, and there's going to be this oppression that's going to come. And I think coming in is more about realizing that you are in this role as a Winkti or a Two-Spirit or whatever that traditional role is, learning about what that role means, and then coming into your community in that role to fulfill your social and spiritual responsibilities, I guess, for your community.
So it's about taking up a new role.
Yeah.
In your community. And do people who you come across then, do they sort of acknowledge that new role, saying, you know, you're moving into this now?
I think so. I've had relatives who've told me that and have asked me to do different things based upon learning of that. And I think, you know, back in the day, a long time ago, there used to be a test that they would do where they'd kind of, you know, put different male and female identified objects in a space and then ask you to go in and grab one of them for different people. And based on what you grab, kind of they decide if you're going to be in this, whether or not you're a Winkti or whether or not you're, you know, something else.
Can I ask what the objects would be? I mean, do you know?
Oh, like maybe a bow would be like a male object and a basket might be like a female type object, those kind of things. And then they would ask, you know, grandma might ask you to go bring something to her, and then grandpa might ask you to bring something to him, and seeing how that works. And I think the person who is being tested kind of would know that they're being tested. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't like this, you know,
it wasn't a trick question.
Right. So they'd know when they brought it back that would what it meant. And then usually there'd be some elder or somebody who would take on teaching people those responsibilities.
So there would be an elder teaching someone. Is that still part of Winkti today, where you choose the role and someone sort of says, here's the new path that you're walking?
I think there's elders that have taught me things, or people who've been in the community a long time. And I also think that my friend calls me the gay whisperer, because I think there's sometimes younger folks who are coming out or coming in and have lots of questions, or, you know, and they sort of come to me and talk to me about it. And so sometimes I take on that role where I help folks.
So you're an elder now. You're doing that role.
I don't like to think of myself that way.
You're too young to be an elder, but you have wisdom that you're sharing.
Yeah. I think elder is also a new concept. It wasn't something that we thought of. Like, it's fairly new. I think we thought of people as elders because of the knowledge that they had. And we sort of thought that if somebody had lived that long, in order to live that long, they had to have wisdom. And so that was really kind of, I think, what's the reflection of.
Well, today in the United States and here in Wisconsin, there's a lot of attention right now focused on same-sex marriages and what's happening there. And some tribes allow same-sex marriage. What is your take as you hear all of this going on?
Well, I think one of the things I always think is funny is that people say, like, you know, marriage is a man and a woman. That's always the way it's been. And that's traditional marriage. And I laugh when I hear that, because traditionally in my community and many other communities, you know, we had what you would call gay marriage way back before colonization ever came. And so it's traditional in the North America, whether you like it or not. And just maybe rediscovering that now and identifying with. I think that's interesting.
Do you share that with people, saying, you know what?
I do. But then sometimes I feel like I get on a soapbox too much. But I usually share it when I hear it. You know, if people, I don't meet too many people who are terribly, you know, want to share important things with me and say, are very, let's say, opinionated.
Well, I want to ask you, there are more than two genders in many Native American communities, not just, you know, what you might expect, the male and female. What are some of the other things that are common?
Well, I think each community or each tribe has their own idea of what gender is or how it looks and how it works, and also sexual orientation and what that looks like. So in my example, being Winkta is both my sexual orientation and my gender. And I think that for other communities, in some communities, they might have up to six different genders. So they might have your standard, you know, male and female, and then they might have a male-bodied female and a female-bodied male. And then on top of that, they might have like what we would consider gay or lesbian. And then on top of that, they might have like a go-between, where that's strictly the person that's not meant to be fulfilled in any one of those other places concretely.
And is that something that's still, you know, common today, that people would identify as one of those six?
That I'm not sure, because those aren't my communities. I didn't grow up with them, so no. I don't know how that works. I would think so. I know I've heard several different languages that they speak of. I think with boarding schools and a lot of the colonization historical trauma, I think there's also homophobia that exists in Indian country too. And so for a long time, some of those things were suppressed in our culture, along with many of our, you know, language and cultural rights and all that kind of stuff. So I think as people are really struggling to try and regain and learn more about the historical things that have to do with their communities.
So in Western European culture, there seems to be this strong correlation between how you behave sexually and how you get identified. For instance, a man who has sex with another man is considered gay. Is the same true in a Native American community? If you're a man and you have sex with other men, does that make you a Winkta? Or is it something that's more rich and nuanced than that?
Yeah, I think what we do with what's between your legs is definitely a Western idea of how we sort of sort out things. I think in Indian country, and specifically in my community or with Lakota folks, Winkta is a role. It's a role that you would fulfill and you'd live into. And so we as a Winkta could date, like I would date men, you know, and I've heard of Winkta dating women too, but I could sleep with a man, and that man's not considered a Winkta. In fact, he would still be probably, by Western standards, considered heterosexual. And let's say I were with him, we got married, we lived together. If later we were to get divorced, he would go back into the pool of other men that could potentially be married by other women. So it's not quite like that. And traditionally, we weren't always the most monogamous culture either, so we didn't quite think of things in that very boxy sort of idea. Everything was more like gray and movable and things like that.
What would you like people to know about the Winkta experience and the Two-Spirit experience, I guess, in general, that you've gone through and it might have been forgotten and maybe would help people in the LGBT community now?
Well, I think that as people move forward through their life, one thing that I guess is important is to not co-opt other cultures. When I tell people about, you know, in my culture, being LGBT is considered a good thing, not considered a bad thing. Like, oh, well, that's good. And I want to be thought of that way. And I'm going to da da da. So don't co-opt someone else's culture to become this thing that you're not, which happens often. You know, everybody loves to co-opt American Indian culture. Even what's his name when he wore the headdress and he got, I can't remember what his name is, this singer. Anyway, but that tends to happen. And so, but I always tell people, look in your own community, because in almost every indigenous culture that I know of, there is a role for these folks if you go back far enough. And you sometimes it was suppressed by church and sometimes it was suppressed by colonization, but that role exists for everyone. And you need to kind of look and find that for you.
Well, Isaiah, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate you coming down here to talk today.
It's been a pleasure.
We've been speaking with Isaiah Broken Leg about the Two-Spirit tradition in Native American communities. This conversation is the last installment of our Out in Wisconsin series. During the month of June, we've been featuring stories from Wisconsin's LGBT community. You can find links to other interviews in the series on the Central Time Facebook page. Right now, it's time for our weekly news update with WPR's Assistant News Director, Noah Ofshinsky. On the docket today, new wolf hunt numbers from the DNR, a look at what a Utah ruling could ultimately mean for Wisconsin's recent gay marriage ruling, and the latest update in John Doe. Noah, welcome to Central Time.
It's good to be here. Good afternoon.
We're going to start with some news from the attorney of Francis Schmitz. Tell us what's going on there in this relates to the John Doe case.
Right. So this was a bit of an unexpected turn yesterday, considering how little we've actually heard from the special prosecutor in the John Doe case. But yesterday, the attorney for Francis Schmitz, who is a special prosecutor, released a statement in which he essentially urged people not to jump to conclusions based on the highly publicized documents that were released last week by a judge. Those documents, as you might remember, alleged that Governor Walker was at the center of a criminal scheme to bypass state election laws during the recall elections of 2012.
So he's essentially urging people not to jump to conclusions. So what did the statement essentially say?
Well, basically what this attorney is saying, that these legal documents were basically documents outlining the prosecutor's legal theory, nothing more. They did not, according to Schmitz's lawyers, establish that a crime actually took place.
So I guess the big question is, why was this statement released?
I have to say, it's a bit unclear, but Governor Walker's campaign seized on it immediately, urging the media to, quote, correct the record. The campaign also called on the Burke campaign, his opponent in the upcoming governor's election, to pull an ad that uses some of the media coverage that occurred last week after those documents were released.
And Burke said...
The Burke campaign said no. they're still going to air the ad.
So there's still some fuzziness about the statement that was issued and what exactly it is saying. Do we know what the distinction is that it's making between Governor Walker himself and Governor Walker's campaign?
Right. So it's worth noting that while the statement makes clear Walker was not a target of the investigation, at least at the time that the investigation was suspended, it doesn't say anything about Walker's campaign. So it's unclear whether or not Walker's campaign was a target of the investigation. The investigation, as we've talked about, was also suspended by a federal judge. So it's unclear what they would have found if it had continued. Of course, they may have found nothing. Maybe nothing would have happened. No charges would have been filed. But it's still an open question that this latest statement doesn't address. And of course, those special prosecutors are appealing in hopes of restarting that investigation. So to be continued for
sure.
So it's
suspended for now, but we're going to keep an eye on it. And as we see things keep happening to keep it alive, including this statement from Francis Schmitz. So
yeah.
Going to keep watching that one. We're going to move to the DNR next and some new wolf numbers. What are we seeing there?
So the Natural Resources Board voted this week on this year's wolf hunting quota. Of course, this is an always controversial issue here in Wisconsin. They voted to allow 156 wolves to be taken. That's actually substantially lower than last year, when around 250 were killed during the hunt.
So quite a bit lower. What's the reaction then from hunters and others about that number?
Well, as you might expect, it runs the gamut. Some groups like the Humane Society were satisfied with the new quota simply because it was less than last year. Hunting groups, not so happy. They wanted this year's quota to be closer to something like 350 or so. So that number is right there in the middle between zero and 350.
So we went from 156. Well, we went from 250. That was last year's mm-hmm. to 156 this year's. What accounts for the change?
I think the change reflects a few things. One is, wolf mortality rates in the last 2 years, that has informed what scientists have established as what would be a correct quota. And because also the hunt is still, it's really new. You know, we've only had this hunt, once. So the agency is still trying to figure out how it actually affects the population as a whole. So I think there's going to be a bit of trial and error in all of this. And I think this new quota reflects that.
Any sense that the winter, that we had, the dire winter that seems like it was more of Game of Thrones than Wisconsin winter, had anything to do with the wolf mortality numbers?
Well, I think that certainly played a part in the quotas. But of course, when you look at populations, you have to look at them over time. And so I think it remains to be seen. And of course, as the DNR learns more about how hunts affect the population, I think, we could expect that quota to, maybe go up, maybe go down. We'll see what happens next year.
And one thing that has been a hot button issue around the wolf hunt, besides the wolf hunt itself, is the issue of using dogs. Where are we with that?
Right. So one of the things that won't change this year and wasn't addressed by the Natural Resources Board was the use of dogs. That is still allowed unless a court intervenes. Some folks spoke out against the practice of using dogs at the DNR meeting. The board heard from those folks, but it's not going to affect the rules governing this upcoming hunt.
Okay, and we're going to move on to something else that has been making a lot of headlines in Wisconsin, the gay marriage ban, which was struck down, the ruling recent there. We're going to look at that in Wisconsin via Utah. What are we seeing?
I know. Who knew? So we're going to leave Wisconsin for a bit. We're going to cross the Mississippi River because there was a major ruling in this ongoing court battle over same-sex marriage. The 10th Circuit Court of Appeals, in a 2-1 ruling just a day or so ago, upheld a previous ruling striking down the ban on same-sex marriage in Utah. And why is this significant? This is significant because this is the first time a federal appeals court has weighed in on the issue. Before this, they were all lower courts. This is an appeals court, which is, of course, one step closer to the U.S. Supreme Court.
And what exactly did they say?
So they cited the 14th Amendment, and I'm going to quote directly from the ruling. They say, quote, the 14th Amendment protects the fundamental right to marry, establish a family, raise children, and enjoy the full protection of a state's marital laws. A state may not deny the issuance of a marriage license to two persons or refuse to recognize their marriage based solely upon the sex of the persons in the marriage union. That's directly from that ruling in the 10th Circuit.
So we've got the first appeals court that has ruled on this. As we know, the Wisconsin ruling is headed to a Chicago appeals court.
Right.
If we're trying to get a read on how that might unfold, what do you think? What does it portend?
Well, of course, this is a different set of judges. So there's no telling what they're going to rule. But I think for those people who are closely watching this, this is frankly a big ruling. It technically only affects... let me see. What are some of the states in the 10th Circuit? Utah, Colorado, New Mexico, Kansas, Oklahoma, and Wyoming. But I think people who are paying attention to this look at this as a positive, at least those folks who support gay marriage, look at this as a huge positive development.
So the Utah appeals court, the first, but it's not the only appeals court considering the issue. What other action are we seeing at the appeals level?
Right. So you mentioned that the appeals court here in Chicago is going to be considering the Wisconsin appeal. There are five other appeals courts actually around the country considering the issue. So it's unclear if the Utah case or a different case is going to be the one that makes it up to the Supreme Court. But court watchers, everybody who really pays attention to this thing, expect fully one of these cases to eventually make it to the Supreme Court.
It's an interesting thing watching which one will be the one that makes that leap up.
Yeah, and at this point, it's we just don't know.
And I don't know, how soon do you think we might see something in the Supreme Court?
Well, I hate looking into the future, but I would say the high court could hear arguments in the case, I would say, at least as soon as 2015.
Okay, so maybe that soon and something not just something we're watching here in Wisconsin. The whole country is watching that.
Indeed.
Okay, we're going to move up to northern Wisconsin now and get a mine update. Some movement there with the tribes and something they're requesting from the EPA. What are we looking at there?
Right. So the tribes of northern Wisconsin are looking to frankly, bypass the state government altogether because they haven't been impressed with the way state government has dealt with the mining issue. You know, of course, their goal is to stop this proposed iron ore mine in the Pinoki Hills. And so the Northern Wisconsin's Chippewa Federation sent a letter to the EPA asking the agency to stop all permitting activity in the Pinoki Range. And they were citing the danger it poses to the Lake Superior watershed.
So they sent a letter, and they're asking the EPA to stop permitting activity. What would that accomplish should the EPA respond? I mean, would it really essentially be able to get them to hopscotch over the state?
In a way, the tribes want the EPA to use the Clean Water Act to stop the mining. And there's some precedence to this. And I think this is what sort of prompted this letter or this most recent letter, because this is not the first letter the tribes have written to the EPA. The EPA just recently, citing Section 404C of the Clean Water Act, stopped, for now at least, stopped mining in Alaska, what would have been one of the largest copper, silver, and gold mines in the world. The EPA actually stopped, for now, that mine in Alaska. So I think the tribes here in northern Wisconsin would like the EPA to do the same here in northern Wisconsin.
So their sense is that there is a parallel here, that if it worked for the tribes in Alaska, we've got a similar argument here in Wisconsin.
Right. The mine opponents in Alaska argue that the mine would have destroyed like the $500 million commercial and sport fishery there. A lot of salmon spawn there. And so that's a crucial area for the fishery. And the tribes are essentially making, you know, a similar comparison to what might happen here in northern Wisconsin in the Lake Superior watershed. They argue that this mine, is a danger to the water resources up in northern Wisconsin.
Now, I know Mike Simonson typically follows this with NOAA, but do you happen to know if there's still blast sampling happening there?
I can't say for sure. I don't have an answer to that.
So the EPA has gotten this letter from the tribes. What about a reply? What kind of timeline do you think we're looking at here?
Right. So the tribes actually aren't expecting a reply necessarily to this letter. They are actually meeting in person with the EPA in late August or September, I believe in Chicago. And so I'm sure this letter will come up in that meeting.
So that's typically the way this unfolds, that they send a letter, you don't get something back in the mail or a call, but they'll meet in person, it will be on the table, and everyone will know the issues at stake.
Exactly. So we'll see what happens in August or September. Again, only time will tell if the EPA will take action.
All right, Noah, thanks so much for coming by.
It was good to be here. Thanks.
We've been talking to Noah Ovshinsky, WPR's assistant news director. He joins us every week at this time for a look at state news.
I'm Mike Arnold in for Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Mike, were you a cool kid in middle school?
No. I was in the AV club. So
yeah, that pretty much killed
you
right there.
That pretty much locked me out.
Yeah, that's me too. There was no AV club at my school, but definitely not in the cool kids camp. So a lot of people interested in this news about cool kids and what it has to say later in life. Well, we're going to hear more about that. I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.